The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the January 15th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. The growing conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. What happened? Saudi Arabia severed diplomatic ties with Iran for the first time since 1990 this week in a dispute that began with the beheading of a Shiite cleric, led to a violent attack on a Saudi embassy, and has deepened the sectarian power struggles over the Middle East. Saudi Arabia's Sunni authorities sparked the crisis by announcing the execution of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, a prominent Shiite cleric who had criticized the Saudi monarchy's treatment of the Shiite minority. Sheikh Nimr had helped lead anti-government protests during the Arab Spring in 2011. Angry demonstrations erupted in Shiite Iran, with protesters ransacking and burning the Saudi embassy in Tehran. In response, the Sunni kingdom immediately recalled its diplomats, ordered Iran's officials to leave Riyadh, and suspended flights between the two countries. Four of Saudi Arabia's Sunni allies, Bahrain, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan, also cut or downgraded their diplomatic links with Tehran. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, warned that the Saudi politicians would suffer divine vengeance for executing Nimr, who he called a martyr. The dispute prompted calls for restraint from across the international community. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the U.S. was urging the Saudis and the Iranians not to let the rift derail attempts to bring an end to the civil war in Syria, where the two rivals are actively supporting opposite sides. Direct talks among the conflict's warring parties, overseen by a UN mediator, are scheduled to start on January 25th in Geneva. What the editorial said. This diplomatic rupture marks an ominous start to 2016 for the Middle East, said the Financial Times. Rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran has long been the region's defining political feature, characterized most recently by their proxy sectarian wars in Syria and Yemen. The Saudis' reckless execution of a Shiite dissident takes the Sunni-Shiite conflict to a higher level. The Saudis had to know what reaction this execution would create, said the New York Times. With oil revenues plunging, the House of Saud cynically chose to stir up fears of the Iranian Shiite threat, to distract its population from the cutbacks the Saudis have made to their lavish welfare spending, and to provide a graphic warning of what dissent will bring. Blame President Obama, said the Wall Street Journal. By dramatically reducing American influence in the Middle East and bending over backward to agree to a nuclear deal with Iran, he has left our long-term allies in Riyadh feeling isolated and vulnerable. They feel under threat from Iran, liberated from sanctions, and they don't believe Obama will defend them. In a region racked by civil wars, political upheaval, and Iranian imperialism, the Saudis are the best friend we have. What the columnist said. This conflict isn't really about religion, said Max Fisher in Vox.com. It's driven by the Cold War struggle for influence between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Sunnis and Shiites had gotten along fine for centuries, but after the Arab Spring in 2011, Saudi Arabia and Iran each wanted to fill the power vacuums in fractured nations, so they deliberately stoked sectarian fear and hatred. What began as a recruitment tool has now become a reality. The American policy should be clear, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. The Saudis aren't perfect. Their gender apartheid is sickening. Their promotion of extremist Wahhabi ideology dangerous. But the Iranian regime is far worse. We should stand tall with the Saudis to stop the new Persian Empire. Actually, our alliance with Riyadh gains us virtually nothing, said Daniel Larrison in theamericanconservative.com. From its pitiless and stupid war in Yemen to its destructive meddling in Syria, this supposed ally is becoming increasingly belligerent and is causing the U.S. nothing but headaches and problems. The danger in all this isn't that Iran and Saudi Arabia might go to war, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. It's that the proxy wars they've been waging have become so intricately woven into the region's myriad conflicts, their mutual cooperation has now become essential to any political solution. Defeating ISIS and securing a ceasefire in Syria are difficult enough in the warmest of climates. With Iran and Saudi Arabia no longer on speaking terms, those goals are all but impossible. And a second main story. Militia and feds face off in Oregon. What happened? A small group of armed protesters calling themselves the Citizens for Constitutional Freedom were locked in a standoff with FBI agents in eastern Oregon this week, after seizing a building in a federal wildlife refuge in protest over the imprisonment of two local ranchers. The group's spokesman, Ammon Bundy, said the self-proclaimed militia, believed to number about 20 men, would only vacate the snowy outpost when Dwight and Stephen Hammond were freed from federal prison, where they are serving a 5-year sentence for arson on federal lands. Bundy, who is the son of Cliven Bundy, the Nevada rancher who carried out his own armed standoff against the federal government in 2014 over grazing rights, also demanded that local federally owned land be given back to the people. His brother, Ryan Bundy, said the group was willing to kill and be killed if necessary. Federal authorities initially chose to wait out the protesters rather than risk a raid. By the siege's fourth day, at least one of the protesters appeared eager to end the standoff. I need to get home, said Lavoy Finnicum. I got cows that are scattered and lost. What the columnist said. Talk about double standards, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Imagine if a bunch of black people, filled with rage and armed to the teeth, had taken over a federal building and challenged authorities to kick them out. Or a group of Muslims, labeled as terrorists, of course, rather than patriotic militiamen. I'm pretty sure it wouldn't be wait and see. Probably more like point and shoot. The armed occupation of federal buildings is inexcusable, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But these ranchers have legitimate grievances. The Hammonds were locked up under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act for setting a fire on their own land to fight invasive species, a blaze that then spread over 139 acres of public land. Still, the protest in their name is more farce than fear, said Tony Norman in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. The Hammonds have distanced themselves from the occupation, and though the Bundy posse would love to have a violent confrontation with the feds to prove the government's tyranny, it's only a matter of time before they run out of toilet paper and have to emerge from the compound with their hands up. This standoff is about much more than the Hammonds, said Carissa Wolf in WashingtonPost.com. In the West, frustration over federal land rights has been building for years. The federal government owns a whopping 84.9% of Nevada and 52.9% of Oregon, land that urban officials often dedicate to protecting owls and sage grouse, but which rural communities would rather use to make a living. A fundamental culture divide has been exposed between urbanites who want to protect the environment and locals who say they're simply trying to feed their families. Our controversy of the week: Hillary Clinton. Are Bill's sex scandals relevant? Donald Trump just went there, said Glenn Reynolds in USAtoday.com, after Hillary Clinton called out the Republican frontrunner for having a penchant for sexism. Trump last week fired back, saying Clinton had some nerve playing the women's card when her husband Bill has a terrible record of women abuse. The former president had just begun taking a more active, visible role in her campaign, but Trump instantly focused media and public attention on the more salacious aspects of Bill Clinton's record, thus turning him from a campaign asset to a campaign liability. Hillary Clinton is married to a man who might be the best natural campaigner of his generation, said John Fund in NationalReview.com. The fact remains, however, that he was impeached after having an affair with a 22-year-old White House intern, Monica Lewinsky, was sued by Paula Jones for sexual harassment, and was accused by numerous women of sexual assault and even rape. Fully one-third of voters are too young to remember the 1990s, but as the sordid details of Bill's past resurface, Hillary may find that bringing Bill back comes with a price. Bill Clinton's extramarital dalliances are certainly fair game for Hillary's opponents, said Jim Newell in Slate.com, but that doesn't mean anyone will care. The original Republican obsession with the Lewinsky affair backfired, and President Clinton left office with approval ratings in the 60s, the highest of any departing president since World War II. Are those same scandals, now nearly two decades stale, really going to derail Hillary's campaign for the White House? Bill Clinton may have been unfaithful to his wife, said Mary Sanchez in the Chicago Tribune, but he had a stellar record as a pro-woman president, appointing the first female attorney general and secretary of state, and signing the Violence Against Women Act, along with numerous other policies that enhance the lives and freedoms of women across America. If this election comes down to the Clintons' record on women versus that of Trump, a thrice-married adulterer with a long track of attacking women in misogynistic terms, the smart money is on the Clintons. The relevant issue today isn't that Bill Clinton cheated on his wife. It's that Hillary herself actively worked to ruin the lives of his accusers, said Catherine Timpf in NationalReview.com. During his decades in public life, at least three women, Juanita Broderick, Kathleen Willey, and Jones, leveled credible claims of sexual assault against him, and Hillary's response was to dismiss them as opportunistic liars. Yet in marketing herself as a champion of women, Hillary has embraced the mantra that every rape survivor has a right to be believed. When she was recently asked by a voter about that inconsistency, Hillary stammered, "Everybody should be believed at first, until they are disbelieved based on evidence." Even for her, that's a stunning level of hypocrisy. Hillary's treatment of her husband's accusers is a legitimate issue, said Janelle Ross in WashingtonPost.com. But so are the persistent gender wage gap, paid paternal leave, and access to reproductive health care. Dragging us back into the muck of Bill Clinton's sex life won't address any of that, and women voters aren't likely to be fooled. Perhaps not, said Michelle Goldberg in Slate.com, but the awkwardness of Hillary's position on Bill's accusers may hurt her, if only by undermining Bill's effectiveness as a campaigner and complicating Hillary's feminist message. What a profound sexist irony it would be if Bill's infidelities came back to haunt his wife as she seeks to become the first female president. Well, it was a good week for being taken to the leader. After Hillary Clinton told a New Hampshire newspaper that as president, she would get to the bottom of the mysteries surrounding UFOs. "I think we may have been visited already," Clinton said. "We don't know for sure." It was a good week for the instructive power of pain, after a new study revealed that college football players who practiced without wearing helmets were 30% less likely to suffer potentially dangerous head impacts during games because they learned to stop using their heads as weapons while tackling. It was a good week for raising the next Beyoncé, after a Spanish company unveiled the Baby Pod, a miniature speaker that can be inserted into a pregnant woman's vagina to stimulate the fetus with music and help babies learn to vocalize from the womb. But it was a bad week for brevity after Twitter revealed a new feature that will allow users to post tweets of up to 10,000 characters, a dramatic departure from the social media site's current 140-character limit. It was a bad week for stunts after Motley Crue drummer Tommy Lee was left suspended upside down in midair when his drum kit roller coaster malfunctioned during the band's farewell concert. "I can't believe this is happening on the last night," Lee said, while still dangling. And it was a bad year for your New Year's resolution, after a British study showed that evolution programmed mammals to store fat in cold winter months when food was naturally scarce. What this suggests, said the researcher Andrew Higginson, is that New Year's Day is the worst possible time to start a new diet. While we're here, we'll pick up a boring but important blurb. Ryan pushes Obamacare repeal. After 5 years of trying, Republicans this week were set to send a bill to President Obama's desk for the first time that would repeal key parts of the Affordable Care Act. The legislation, pushed ahead via an obscure budget mechanism known as reconciliation, marks the 62nd attempt by Republicans to repeal the president's signature health care law since 2011. Obama has vowed to veto the bill, and Republicans lack the necessary two-thirds vote in both the House and Senate to override the veto. But House Speaker Paul Ryan said the bill, which would also strip Planned Parenthood of federal funding, was part of the GOP's effort to present a bold alternative agenda during the 2016 election year. On the briefing page, billionaire philanthropy. Mark Zuckerberg's recent pledge to give away his huge fortune follows a long-standing American tradition. Who were the first philanthropists? Wealthy individuals have been spending large sums on good causes for centuries. But it wasn't until the Gilded Age of the early 20th century that modern philanthropy as we know it began. The rise of industrialism had created a major wealth divide between the workers at the bottom and the so-called robber barons at the top. In a bid to address this imbalance and perhaps to improve their reputations as they approached the end of their lives, several of the wealthiest industrialists chose to give away almost all of their fortunes. The movement's pioneer was Andrew Carnegie, the Scottish-born businessman who became the richest man in the world after selling his steel company in 1901. Carnegie believed that successful entrepreneurs were morally obligated to spend their fortunes helping others. As he put it in The Gospel of Wealth, an 1889 article that became a guiding philosophy for philanthropists, "He who dies rich dies disgraced." What did he do with his wealth? By the time he died in 1919, Carnegie had given away more than 90% of his fortune. over $350 million, equivalent to $4.8 billion in inflation-adjusted money, to hundreds of causes. He built more than 2,800 public libraries, founded what is now Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, one of the world's leading research universities, and spent millions constructing New York's Carnegie Hall and other concert venues. Who were the other early philanthropists? Carnegie's successor as the richest man in the world, John D. Rockefeller, followed his lead. The self-made oil magnate's total assets peaked at $1.4 billion, equivalent to $30 billion in today's money. Under the broad mission statement of promoting the well-being of mankind throughout the world, Rockefeller's donations and foundations helped build the University of Chicago, funded medical programs that led to vaccines for meningitis, yellow fever, and other diseases, and built major schools of public health at Johns Hopkins and Harvard. Other large-scale philanthropists included automaker Henry Ford, who created America's largest charitable foundation, and industrialist Jean-Paul Getty, who set up the wealthiest art institution in the world. Though the goals of each philanthropist differed, says Mark Dowie, author of American Foundations, they shared similar motivations: guilt, narcissism, paternalism, the wish for immortality, and a love of humanity. Is that still true? No doubt. Indeed, modern philanthropists have matched and perhaps exceeded their predecessors in both ambition and scale. Bill Gates, the Microsoft founder who became the richest man in the world, current estimated worth $79 billion, set up the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation with his wife in 2000. Gates has already donated $28 billion to the foundation and persuaded the second richest man in the world, investor Warren Buffett, to gradually donate 85% of his own estimated wealth of $66 billion to the organization. The Gates Foundation now has a $45 billion endowment, more than the Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford foundations combined. The Gates Foundation funds are distributed to a wide range of charitable programs, but its main focus is on improving health care in poor countries. Its billion-dollar vaccination programs have helped eradicate polio across most of the developing world and reduce measles deaths by 90%, tuberculosis by 45%, and malaria by 30%. American philanthropy used to be all about giving locally, said Ann Peterson, president of the Global Philanthropy Alliance. But there's been a dramatic trend toward international giving, and that's only going to continue. Have others followed Gates' example? They have, many at his personal behest. In 2010, Gates and Buffett convinced 38 other billionaires to join them in signing the Giving Pledge, a non-binding promise to give away at least half of their wealth to good causes. That list has now grown to 141 billionaires from 16 different countries, worth a cumulative $800 billion. Of course, not everyone has accepted Gates and Buffett's overtures. Maybe I should write a book on how to get by on $500 million, joked Buffett in 2013, because apparently there's a lot of people that don't really know how to do it. What about Zuckerberg? He and his wife pledged to use 99% of their Facebook shares, worth $45 billion, for good causes. The 31-year-old is one of several young tech billionaires with their own foundations. Other include Sean Parker of Napster, Pierre Omidyar from eBay, and Dustin Moskovitz, Facebook. This new wave of philanthropy hasn't been entirely uncontroversial, with critics questioning whether it's anti-democratic for a handful of super-rich people to have such power to set policy and reshape the world. But the philanthropists are unapologetic. All this money is going for charity to help people, reasoned Home Depot founder and Giving Pledge signatory Bernard Marcus. Would they rather we bought yachts and built mansions? And moving on to the columns, we'll start with two from the U.S. First, why 2015 was the best year yet. In many ways, 2015 was an annus mirabilis, a year of wonders and blessings, said Jeff Jacoby. Doomsayers can point to a ghastly terror attacks and devastating civil wars, floods of refugees, and acts of unspeakable cruelty. But the world has always been full of pain and tears, and 2015 saw remarkable progress for humanity as a whole. Just 12 months ago, history's worst Ebola epidemic was killing thousands of West Africans and causing worldwide panic. Today, only a handful of cases remain, and a new vaccine appears to be 100% effective. Global female literacy has passed 93%, up from 40% in the 1970s. Despite the chaos in Syria and Iraq, free elections and peaceful transfers of power took place in countries ranging from Nigeria to Argentina to Myanmar to Burkina Faso. In the U.S., mass shootings dominated headlines, yet the latest FBI report shows that violent crime was down, not up, over 2014. On the whole, economist Charles Kinney argues it was the best year in history for the average human being to be alive. Our species is hardwired for pessimism, with a penchant for romanticizing the past. But these really are the good old days. Next year will be even better. And a second one, black but not a victim. Though I'm a black man of mixed race heritage who has encountered plenty of racism, I do not consider myself a victim, said Thomas Chatterton Williams. My black father, born in segregated Texas, raised my siblings and me to value education and self-reliance, and we hold graduate degrees, own businesses, and in my case, write for a living, an incredible luxury. Yet I've been told by activists that stories like mine or Barack Obama's are irrelevant oddities, and that continued systemic racism is so oppressive that people of color have little chance of success. I find this pessimism to be frustrating, untrue, and highly damaging to black progress. By insisting that race is a defining characteristic that can never be transcended, leftist activists now share assumptions with the worst conservative and even white supremacist ideology. And by portraying black people as inherently disadvantaged, we give white people too much credit and strengthen the status quo. Yes, bigotry is a tenacious foe, but we should open our eyes to the reality that a growing number of black people are seizing the freedom to define ourselves, not as victims, but as equals. And this from Germany. How dangerous is Mein Kampf? For the first time in seven decades, Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf is back in German bookstores, said Peter von Becker in Der Tagesspiegel. Reprints of the Nazi leader's ultra-nationalist anti-Semitic manifesto have been banned here by the book's copyright holder, the state of Bavaria, since the end of World War II. But under German law, a copyright expires 70 years after the author's death. So on January 1st, Mein Kampf entered the public domain, even though many Germans still consider Hitler's book dangerous, particularly now when xenophobic forces are once again on the rise. To help combat those fears, scholars at Munich's Institute for Contemporary History have spent 6 years putting together a new annotated edition of Mein Kampf. Hitler's 600 pages have been swelled to about 2,000, thanks to 3,500 academic notes that set the work in historical context. That context is crucial, said the Institute's director, Andreas Wirsching, in Focus. The hundreds of experts who toiled on the edition all agree. It would be simply irresponsible to let this racist work of inhumanity wander loose in the public domain without comment. Hitler's 1925 book contains many outright lies and many more half-truths and distortions. By exposing his propagandist methods, we can keep the fatal experiences of German history in our consciousness in a scientifically sound form. Yet the commentary is so exhaustive as to approach overkill, said Patrick Bonners in Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. No assertion of Hitler's goes unchallenged in the new edition, not just his abuses of historical fact, but also his depraved ideology. Even the anti-Semitism is to be scientifically disproved. This approach gives the book a kind of talk show effect. First, Hitler has the mic, then comes the rebuttal, and now back to Hitler. All that analysis gives his megalomaniacal juvenile work a gravitas it does not deserve, said Peter Wittewald Pohl in The horrific facts of Hitler's legacy are already clear to everyone. Concentration camps, the Holocaust, millions of people dead, persecuted, displaced, or humiliated. Isn't that enough to discredit him? What can 3,500 annotations and 1,400 extra pages add? In fact, the book never should have been banned in the first place, said George Diaz in Der Spiegel. Banning a book is a sign of fear and weakness. It is what dictatorships do, not democracies. Perhaps the ban is explained by the panic that seized the Germans in 1945 after the Allied victory, when they looked in the mirror and saw a nation of murderers. We could not punish all of them, so we scapegoated the Nazi leader's largely autobiographical book. Yet the ban served only to concentrate the guilt of the nation in the figure of Hitler, when really there were millions of Germans who were perpetrators. Reading Mein Kampf did not magically transform us into murderers. We did that all by ourselves. And the last word, the quest to change the weather. Pilots are risking their lives flying into thunderheads to suppress fierce hailstorms that destroy farmers' crops. Writer Justin Noble explains how weather modification works. The storm is fierce and glowing turquoise, and Stephanie Royal is waiting for it at the border of Montana and North Dakota, circling 7,000 feet high in a tiny Piper Seneca. Back on the ground, Wayne Nark, a sixth-generation North Dakota farmer, fearfully watches the sky. The strange tropical ocean-colored clouds indicate light reflecting off bits of ice in the storm's core. This means hail, a potential death sentence for farmers like Mark, whose 6,000 acres of wheat, barley, corn, and sunflowers lie striped across picturesque rolling plains in the state's southwestern corner near the Badlands. We've had hailstorms here where there is nothing left, said Mark. In mere minutes, millions of dollars of plant material can be smashed to bits. It's a crop's version of death by stoning. The job of pilots like Royal is to fly directly in at monstrous thunderstorms and discharge chemicals into a particular part of the cloud, a technique called cloud seeding, intending to suppress the storm's ability to produce hail. But on this late June day, the storm racing across the prairie is outmaneuvering the 22-year-old Texan pilot. I started approaching from the east, which is the front of the storm and should have been kind of calm, said Royal, but it was so turbulent that my seatbelt wouldn't even stay fastened. So she turns back, and for the moment, the lives of Mark's crops hang in the balance. Florida has the sun, Buffalo gets snow, and the Gulf Coast faces hurricanes. North Dakota is hail country. In late spring and summer, winds blowing east over the Rocky Mountains tap moisture streaming north from the Gulf of Mexico to create massive thunderstorms on the Great Plains that frequently produce hail. Unfortunately, the hail belt also happens to be the farm belt. In North Dakota, about 90% of the land is covered by crops or used for cattle ranching, meaning if it is hailing, someone's plants are probably getting pelted, if not completely crushed. Hail in this region can tear the shingles off roofs, pot cars so badly they look as if they were sprayed from above with a machine gun, and pile so deep that snow plows need to be called out. A 1980 storm in Orient, Iowa, left hail drifts 6 feet high. Death comes with hail. The ice chunks bludgeon to death birds, cows, and people. The last known human fatality in the U.S. was in 2000, when a 19-year-old Texas man was struck by a softball-sized hailstone estimated to be traveling at 100 miles per hour. Hail causes about $1 billion in crop damage and property damage annually. One common safeguard against the ice is hail insurance. But in the hail belt, there is a more proactive means of protection. Cloud seeding pilots like Stephanie Royal. Royal's employer is Weather Modification Incorporated, or WMI, the world's largest company of its kind and one of the oldest, started by a group of Bowman, North Dakota wheat farmers in 1961. To call what we do weather modification is misleading, said WMI Vice President of Meteorology Bruce Bowe, a sturdy man with a crew cut and a master's degree in atmospheric science. We are not modifying weather so much as modifying clouds. The history of weather modification was, until fairly recently, littered with failures. In the first century, the Greek historian Plutarch hypothesized that rain followed military battles. This theory died hard. Napoleon believed volleys of gunfire could bring rain, as did the U.S. Civil War Brigadier General Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. In the late 1800s, the U.S. Congress bankrolled a project to initiate rain over West Texas using an elaborate system of kites and homemade mortar. Despite somewhat promising early results, the effort was eventually deemed a disaster. War played a role in WMI's genesis, too. After World War II and the Korean War, many North Dakota-bred fighter pilots returned to the farm, only to have their crops ruined by a succession of hailstorms. As North Dakota farmers were pioneering ways to halt hail, the U.S. government, spurred into action by the Soviets, who were claiming great success using rockets to seed clouds, was initiating Project Skywater. From mountaintop stations across the Rockies, government scientists were spraying clouds with silver iodide. We had just come out of World War II and felt we were on top of the world, says Bowe. We thought we could do anything. We could be Adam, and humanity had no bounds on what science could do. During the 1960s and 70s, the project, monitored by the National Science Foundation and the National Center for Atmospheric Research, continued in eastern Colorado as the National Hail Research Experiment. But after several summers, scientists concluded there was no evidence that their work was enhancing rain or reducing hail, and killed the project, which joined a long list of failed government weather mod schemes. Despite Bowe's aversion to the idea of weather modification, the term favored by the industry is weather mod, and few people realized just how much the process may be affecting their lives. If you fly into Salt Lake City in winter, a weather mod company may have helped clear the fog that allowed your plane to land. If you water ski on Lake Mead in summer, weather mod may have helped to prime the clouds that poured the rain that meandered into the rivers to fill the lake. And if you were in Philadelphia or New York City and dared to eat a peach or plum or apricot or nectarine, it may well have come from California's Central Valley, irrigated by water channeled from snowmelt on the Sierra Nevada mountain range, above which WeatherMod planes regularly fly, aiming to enhance snowfall. WeatherMod goes far beyond the borders of North America. WMI pilots have flown airplanes into thunderstorms on six continents. The company has worked to suppress hail in Argentina and Alberta, build snowpack in California and Wyoming, and enhance rain in Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Mexico, India, Morocco, and Mali. Typically, the company's contact is with government agencies or militaries, but not always. An unusual request came from lush Papua New Guinea, where a copper mine wanted WMI to help boost rainfall during the dry season in order to keep a steady flow in rivers that run the hydroelectric dams that power the mine. "What we are really doing," Bo says, speaking about rainfall enhancement, "is making clouds a little more efficient, or in the case of hail, making them a little less deadly." Rain falls regularly from clouds onto our umbrellas and faces, yet rarely do we contemplate its dramatic journey. To do so, first erase your mental image of water. It is nothing but a loosely knit collection of H2O molecules, which we call a liquid. Ice is a tightly packed collection of H2O molecules, a solid, and a bunch of H2O molecules on their own constitutes water vapor, a gas. Sun-heated air and water vapor near the Earth's surface float up into the sky and cool while rising. The air condenses, and the H2O molecules are drawn closer together. Water vapor cannot become liquid water without the help of tiny wind-blown particles in the atmosphere, such as dust, soot, and salt. These particles serve as collection points, drawing water vapor molecules into a glob of water called a cloud droplet, the beginnings of a cloud. Still, cloud droplets are small, typically 5 to 10 microns across, and one must collide with a million other cloud droplets before becoming large enough to form the thing we call a raindrop. In 1946, the atmospheric scientist Bernard Vonnegut, novelist Kurt's older brother, discovered that when compounds like silver iodide are dropped into clouds, they act like the dust, soot, or salt, and enable water vapor to cling to them, jump-starting the raindrop formation process. Rain can't be created from nothing, but clouds can be made more efficient at producing it, or so says the science of cloud seeding. Ice crystals are formed in basically the same way as rain. Like the change from vapor to liquid, water is sluggish in its transition to ice. But again, particles in the atmosphere help draw liquid water in and lock it into place to become solid. The thinking behind hail suppression is that spraying silver iodide into a developing thunderhead, the birthplace of all hailstones, spawns an army of smaller ice particles that use up the available cloud water, thus preventing the larger crop-crushing hailstones from forming. WMI planes are equipped with silver iodide burners on both wings, each capable of running for about 2 to 2.5 hours. Silver iodide flares sit in racks under the wings. Upon release, they last anywhere from around 30 seconds to 2 minutes and deliver a concentrated dose to the would-be ice particles. Stephanie Royal has turned her Piper Seneca around to flee the storm and its turbulence, but already racing toward the cell is colleague Vadim Alexeyev, 26, in a Cessna 340. He approaches from the south and finds a clear, less turbulent path to the edge of the storm. Here he spots what he's looking for, a shelf, or fluffy layer of clouds just below the base of the thunderhead. Alexeyev turns on his burners, and lo and behold, Royal is back. She follows Alexeyev's route into the storm and switches on her burner. Alexeyev also unloads 2 burn-in place flares, an extra bump of silver iodide. Although it is impossible to instantaneously assess if the dosage has any effect, the storm is weakening, and within minutes it vanishes altogether. "It was amazing," says Royal. Once it started dissipating, there was nothing. No trace of the storm had ever been there. The effectiveness of cloud seeding has been hotly debated. WMI's Beau points to evidence published in reputable scientific journals that indicates seeding clouds for snowfall enhancement can show a 5 to 15% increase in precipitation, but these assessments tend to be weighed down with caveats. A more thorough assessment entails lacing seeded clouds with a tracer that can later be detected in the actual rain or snowfall that makes it to the ground. But such projects are prohibitively expensive and still don't necessarily confirm that the precipitation would not have fallen anyway. Measuring the success of hail suppression is just as difficult. I'm not aware of any statistical evidence that it works, says Harold Brooks, a senior research scientist at the National Severe Storms Laboratory in Norman, Oklahoma. Mind you, it's very difficult to design and carry out experiments to test it. Perhaps the best analysis comes from Beau himself. It is not a total solution, but it works, he says, and it is comparatively cheap, and not doing it is so disastrous that our clients are happy to do it. With climate change exacerbating the already delicate dynamic between weather and farming, one would imagine this niche industry to blossom. We're staying busy, says Beau. Interest is increasing, I think because of increasing water supply pressures. He is hesitant to peg the increased interest to climate change, but says that what we do know is that there is increased demand for water. Back on the ranch, Wayne Mark is quick to defend WeatherMod. I remember back when I was young, we never expected to get a crop harvested completely without losing some to hail, and in some years losing all of it to hail. But, he adds, since weather modification started, losses have gone down, and in the last 5 years, we've had very little measurable hail damage. It's still summer, though, and the black wedge of a thunderstorm can consume the horizon on almost any given day. If I can only make it through the harvest, then I am golden, says Mark, with an eye to the sky. But if just one of them storms comes, I am done. This was excerpted from an article that was originally published by Atlas Obscura and Long Reads. We're going to read one of the obituaries this week. The prankster who led the Harlem Globetrotters. Meadowlark Lemon, 1932 to 2015. Meadowlark Lemon was 11 when he saw the newsreel that would change his life. Sitting in a cinema in the Jim Crow South, he watched in awe as the barnstorming basketball troupe, the Harlem Globetrotters, tore across the screen. The players were unlike any I had ever seen, he said. They laughed, danced, and did ball tricks. Something else about them, the team struck Lemon. They were all black men, the same color as me. Lemon made it his goal to become a Globetrotter, an ambition he more than achieved. During his 24-year career with the team, the 6'3" center became the Globetrotters' main showman, loved for his slapstick comedy routines and his array of trick shots. My destiny, he said, was to make people happy. Born to a poor family in Wilmington, North Carolina, Lemon learned to play basketball using an empty evaporated milk can and a hoop fashioned out of an onion sack and a wire coat hanger, said the Washington Post. Through hours of practice, Lemon became an all-state high school player before enlisting in the Army. He tried out for the Globetrotters while stationed in Austria and joined the team full-time in 1954. A slick ball handler, Lemon could make jaw-dropping half-court hook shots and no-look behind-the-back passes, said the Los Angeles Times. He was also a natural comic who made crowds erupt in laughter by sneaking up and spying on the opposition's huddle, pouring buckets of water and confetti on the heads of referees and spectators, and mimicking baseball and football plays. "You first had to prove that you could play basketball," he said. "Then you had to show that you could be funny." Before Lemon quit the Globetrotters over a pay dispute in 1979, he and his team played almost everywhere, from high school gyms to Madison Square Garden, to an exhibition in Moscow during the Cold War, said CNN.com. Though the Globetrotters were sometimes criticized for their buffoonish image, some called the all-black team a traveling minstrel show, Lemon always believed they had helped the civil rights movement by performing in front of adoring crowds of all races. "America needed Sammy Davis Jr. and Louis Armstrong," he said, "and America and the world at one time needed people like the Harlem Globetrotters and Meadowlark Lemon." On the health and science page, the surprising origins of the Irish. The Irish people have a complex genetic history shaped by mass migrations from the Middle East and Spain, with blue eyes and fair skin arriving through a later migration from Eastern Europe, new DNA evidence indicates. The evidence was found in the bones of four people buried in Ireland: a brown-eyed, black-haired female who lived on a farm some 5,200 years ago, discovered buried in a small village in Northern Ireland, and three men who lived between 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, found on Rathlin Island, just off the Irish coast. When researchers analyzed the woman's genome, they discovered a strong similarity to people from Spain and Sardinia, who are believed to have originally migrated to Europe from the Middle East. The genomes from the three Bronze Age men revealed a different genetic background, with about 30% of their DNA closely resembling populations from modern-day Russia and Ukraine. These blue-eyed males also had a genetic variant linked to a hereditary iron overload disorder, which is so prevalent in Ireland that it's known as Celtic disease. Researchers said their findings show that modern Irish were largely shaped by 1,000 years of migration from Eastern Europe. There was a great wave of genome change that swept into Europe from above the Black Sea into Bronze Age Europe, and we now know it washed all the way to the shores of its most westerly island, said study author Dan Bradley. He said the migrants may have even brought the introduction of language ancestral to the Western Celtic tongues. And on the Talking Points page, Iran, a pointed message from the mullahs. "So much for detente," said Helen Cooper and David Sanger in the New York Times. 6 months after Iran agreed to curb its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief, hopes are fading that the historic deal will lead to an easing of hostility between Tehran and the West. White House officials announced last week that they were preparing a new, limited set of sanctions against the Islamic regime in response to two ballistic missile tests it recently conducted in defiance of a UN ban. That announcement came only days after the Iranian Navy fired rockets that passed within just 1,500 yards of a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf, an act somewhere between recklessness and outright aggression. Neither provocation threatens the nuclear agreement itself, which will reach its official implementation day within weeks. But the grander objective of the deal, to bring Iran into the community of nations, remains a long way away. Surprise, surprise, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Tehran knows that President Obama will do anything to preserve a deal that he thinks is central to his foreign policy legacy, so it now has free rein to intimidate its foes. And if this is how the mullahs are behaving before the deal has gone into place, Imagine how they'll act after they get their hands on $100 billion of unfrozen assets. Obama's defenders are blaming Iran's mean hardliners for undermining the deal, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Memo to these amateur Tehranologists. The hardliners run Iran. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guard approved the accord only because they decided the terms were in their interest. The mullahs have no interest in better relations with the U.S. They want to become the dominant power in the Middle East. Iran's provocative behavior has certainly made the situation awkward, said Joshua Keating in Slate.com, but it doesn't really undermine the underlying goal of the nuclear deal. A Russian ship has just removed virtually all, more than 25,000 pounds, of Iran's enriched uranium, and Iran no longer has the capability to produce a single nuclear weapon. That's a very significant achievement. Though he obviously hopes for more in the long term, Obama was always careful to specify that the deal only applied to Iran's nuclear program rather than the wider disagreements between Washington and Tehran. In the short term, at least, we'll remain enemies. On the subject of Iran, we have a short note. Iran executes far more people than Saudi Arabia, which put more than 150 people to death in 2015. Amnesty International reports that Iran executed 694 people in just the first 6 months of 2015 and likely killed more than 1,000 over the full year. We'll finish with a quote from Lemmy Kilmister. If you think you're too old to rock and roll, then you are. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138.